What's better than earning money from a 9-to-5 job? It's earning money while you sleep, which is made possible if you start investing. You're listening to the Real Estate Investing Demystified with your very own dynamic duo, Ava Benesaki and August Binias. Tune in as we discuss everything real estate, both on the passive and active sides. We feature life-changing stories of today's real estate leaders that will help build your own roadmap to success. This is a show that will lead you to a diversified portfolio, a much bigger revenue, and a next-level venture that brings you a smooth cash flow. Let's get this episode started. All right, everyone, welcome back to Real Estate Investing Demystified.
Welcome back. Yeah, it's a beautiful summertime here in Vancouver, west coast of Canada, scorching out there in the U.S. I was talking to someone from Texas today, and it's super hot. And then Florida, obviously, not only hot, but humid as well. But global warming, it's taking its toll on the world. I don't know about that. But anyways, interesting stuff. You know, these days, I had a recent presentation on Built to Rent when we talked about my demystified Built to Rent, and I gave a presentation. We had a bunch of attendees. But I spent a lot of my time on geopolitics. But it's, you don't want to mix the two. You want to keep that separate. That world of geopolitics and the world of real estate investing. We deal with investors and we're going to conversate about this idea of investors and raising money from our guest today. But you want to keep this separate. You never want to talk to an investor about your political views or ideas because right away that's...
It can make it or break it for you.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. So good point. And you actually did I gave you a 10 out of 10 on that.
I know. I appreciate that. I'm always very hard on you when you do presentations. Just they're ripping you apart. And then I do one and you give me a 10 out of 10. I was expecting, I must have done really well.
I was being honest.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. You're very welcome.
I talk slow. That's what I did. My mother all my life has told me talk slow. I've been able to do it sometimes, but most times I talk really fast. At least people don't have to press 2x or 1.5x when they listen to me podcasts. I'm just quick, to the point, laconic, as they say.
That's right.
So let's get into, and quickly, last point about our show, Real Estate Investing Demystified. We bring on a diverse group of guests, but today we're going to be talking about a different asset class under the commercial real estate umbrella, which is self-storage. Very interesting asset classes. It behaves very similarly to other asset classes because at the end of the day, it's about a deal, it's about the money, it's about executing the business plan. So why don't we go ahead and tell people about our guests and start off the show?
I would love to. All right, everyone. Today we are joined by Neil Henderson, professional real estate investor, co-host of the Truly Passive Income podcast, and general partner at Nomad Capital, a Wilmington, North Carolina-based self-storage syndication firm specializing in conversions. Neil's journey began with house hacking his Las Vegas home, accelerating his family's path to financial independence, and fueling his passion for the FIRE movement, which is financial independence, retire early movement. After nearly two decades as a defense contractor, he transitioned full-time into real estate, syndicating over $75 million in commercial transactions and helping raise $17 million in investor equity. So welcome to the show, Neil. We're excited to get into everything with you.
Welcome. Thank you for that lovely introduction, Ava and August. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. Neil, like for those who haven't met you yet, maybe you can share your journey from being a defense contractor and then to pivoting to a real estate investor.
Yeah, I'll give you the brief version. I transitioned from a career in acting in 2003 and became a defense contractor. Did that for 18 years. We bought a house in Las Vegas in 2013, summer of 2013. Had a little guest house on the front of it for about 30 seconds. That was going to be my ultimate man cave before my wife said, absolutely not. That's going to be the place where our guests come and stay, specifically my in-laws and people who are coming to Las Vegas to visit us. We pointed that little guest house like a nice little hotel room. We added like a little coffee bar, a small microwave, a little refrigerator and things like that. And it was a great little space. No intention of doing anything more than that with it. And then Christmas Day in 2013, my mom, who's one of the smartest business people I've ever known, with nothing but a high school degree, came to me and she handed me this article about this company called Airbnb. And she said, you know, I think it'd be a really great idea if you guys rent out your little guest house on this platform. And I was like, yeah, whatever, mom. But my mom had always been coming to me with business ideas for myself, everything from mobile car washes to photography, things like that. And this one was finally, I sort of went away and thought about it. And in January of 2014, I was like, all right, I'll give this a try. Went out, took some photos of the space, wrote up a description of it, listed it on Airbnb. And within 48 hours, we had our first booking and we were one of the highest rated listings for the next 5 years in Las Vegas. We're 65% occupied every year, and it allowed us to pay down our mortgage as an accelerated rate and allowed my wife to be a stay-at-home mom when the birth of our son. And it gave me a taste for real estate. And I'll stop there. I sort of then branched out into other real estate, but that was kind of the first thing that gave me the taste of real estate and gave me the bug.
Yeah, I can't believe you left defense contracting, which is 2003. I mean, the 9/11 was 01, so it was a good time to be in defense contracting, particularly sometimes the opponents of U.S. foreign policy says that U.S. foreign policy is in perpetual war. So you left one great business for another great business. Talk to us about moving from single family kind of house hacking type of style to actually looking at larger deals, this concept of real estate private equity or syndications that is known. Talk to us about that transition.
And how did you get introduced to it?
Well, it was not a straight path by any stretch of the imagination. We were operating the short-term rental. We very much sort of, at that time, were sort of ready, fire, aim. We just kind of put it up and learned as we went, made a bajillion mistakes, but none of them fatal. It literally, the property was outside our front door. We cleaned it ourselves early on. We handled all the guest communication, all things like that. It was the closest thing I'd ever experienced to mailbox money at the time. And it took about a year before I was like, wow, this is really, when I sat down and like did the math of how much we were making, I was like, wow, this is really good. I've got to figure out a way to scale this. I started researching and I came across an article written by a woman by the name of Paula Pant, who's got a well-known website called affordanything.com. And she was a long-term rental investor based in Atlanta. And she'd written an article about converting one of her long-term rentals into a short-term rental. And she was comparing the ROI on it, the ROT, return on time. And I don't remember much about the article, but I remember there was a little link over on the side of her website to a website called Bigger Pockets. And that was when I first became exposed to Bigger Pockets. I clicked on that link and I went down the rabbit hole. If anybody has ever fallen down that Bigger Pockets rabbit hole, it's deep. I ended up probably for the next 6 months just consuming every Bigger Pockets podcast I could get my hands on, drove my family and friends nuts with a new strategy probably every week. You know, oh my God, you've got lease option sandwiches, small multifamily, self-storage, large multifamily, you know, you name it, note investing. And they thought I was crazy. But so I was struggling to find a strategy that would work for me where I was based on my time, experience, and the money that I had. And I ended up, went to some of the local RIAs in Las Vegas, which is mostly house flippers. And I really had no desire to flip houses in Las Vegas. It's kind of a house flipping market. I looked into scaling short-term rentals. By then, Las Vegas was already getting a little hostile to short-term rentals, so I was a little hesitant to go too far down that path. But a friend of mine, a local real estate house flipper, said, hey, there is a new real estate conference that's having its first meeting in February in Denver. You should go. It's called the Best Ever Real Estate Conference, put on by a guy by the name of Joe Fairless. Had never heard of him. And I had no business being at this conference. I was like, ah, sure, whatever, I'll go. And so I went, and it's primarily a syndicators conference, primarily multifamily at the time. It was a few self-storage, retail, all kinds like that. And I remember the first day at the conference, I'm sitting there going, what am I doing here? I have no business being here. I haven't even bought a long-term rental, and I'm sitting here listening to people talk about buying multi-million dollar multifamily properties. And I sat there, and there was a speaker by the name of Scott Myers, and he was talking about self-storage. And that was the first time I'd ever heard about self-storage as an asset class. And it just clicked for me. It made sense. And they broke for lunch. And I went downstairs to the lunch buffet room, and I sat, grabbed my lunch, and I sat down at the lunch buffet table that changed the course of my life. There was a man there sitting, telling a story. His name was Eric Hemingway. He was telling the story about how he built his first self-storage facility in 2006 in Prescott, Arizona, and then proceeded to go and live on a sailboat with his family for 3.5 years in the Mediterranean, sailing all over. They ended up sailing across the Atlantic and settling in Wilmington. I was like, I need to get to know this guy. And that was how I met my now business partner, Eric Hemingway. And I'll stop there because otherwise I'll just go on and on.
I love it. That's a really exciting story. Best Ever Conference, we're familiar with Joe Fairless. I actually spoke at his conference. I spoke on stage there a couple years ago now, I think 2 years ago. But I love it. That's where your eyes opened up to this whole new world. I would actually love for you, Neil, to give us a crash course on self-storage. And kind of what you guys look for. Do you develop them? Do you buy already stabilized self-storages? Like, what's the business model? How does it all work? Would love for you to give our viewers and ourselves a crash course, please.
So storage, it's a very simple asset class. Pardon me. Caught what you had, August.
Yeah.
It's a simple asset class. It's a commercial asset class. It basically involves renting people boxes of air. Most storage operators will keep things simple. People are renting on a month-to-month lease. You don't have long-term leases. Oftentimes when people rent a unit from you, most people expect to be there 3 months. The average person rents a storage facility for about 18 months on average. And so usually what will happen is you'll move your stuff into a self-storage facility, and then you will, you know, you'll come in at a certain rate, and within usually about 3 months, they're going to raise your rates about 10, 15%, which is usually not enough to get most people to move out. And then the longer you stay there, usually every 3 months, they're usually going to do rate increases until people cry uncle. As an asset class, it's got a lower expense ratio than multifamily. Multifamily will tend to be about 50% of your expenses are going to go out to expenses, not including debt service. Whereas self-storage, it's typically a lower expense ratio. It's around 30%. So you get to keep almost 70% of, you know, whatever your gross revenues are, of course, not including debt service. There's typically, I would say, 4 to 5 primary strategies with self-storage. There's buy an existing facility and expand it. It's got room for expansion. You can buy an existing facility and do an operational turnaround. You're just, you know, raising rents. You can develop from the ground up, or you can do self-storage conversions. You can take an old, empty, big box retail building, like an old Kmart, an old warehouse, an old mill, whatever, an old office building sometimes, and convert it to self-storage. And then obviously sometimes there's the, you know, where they just buy existing and they're just buying cash flow. You know, there's usually somebody who's borrowing at a significantly lower amount than the federal rate. They're usually using insurance money to buy it. We like the conversion strategy because it's sort of the best of, but we like heavy value add. We're typically buying, you know, if you or I were to go out and build a facility from the ground up, on average these days, it's going to cost us about $120 a square foot, not including the cost of the land. And then it's going to take us anywhere from 12 to 36 months to entitle the land and to prep the land before you even really start to turn a shovel and start to put up the bricks and sticks. With conversion, we're typically buying on average for about $25 a square foot, oftentimes below the replacement cost. And then we're usually doing the conversion for about $45 a square foot. So on average, we're all in for about $65 to $70 a square foot. And that includes the cost of land, the building, the conversion, everything. So we're in, and it typically only takes us about 12 months from the time we acquire the building to the time that our doors are open. So we're cheaper and faster to market.
And then let me ask you, what does it look like as far as, like, what's your business model? Are you looking to hold it long term? Are you looking to hold it for 3 to 5 years, 2 years? Talk to us about that.
So when we started off, we really wanted our idea, and it's our preferred exit. Preferred business plan is to buy and hold for the long term with our investors. We create such significant value in year one that we're typically, if lease up goes the way we project, around year five, we're able to do a cash out refinance, which comes out 100% tax-free for the investors without stressing the asset. And then everybody stays in it long term. We continue to cash flow. Now, obviously that it's very market dependent, both on the local market and also the macro market. Interest rates have shot up significantly, you know, in the last 3 years. Sometimes it doesn't make sense to do a cash out refinance. And also it doesn't often make sense to hold it long term. There's an awful lot of money that's coming together in the last 12 months to buy self-storage. And so we're starting to see a period where cap rates are going to start compressing again with self-storage, because there hasn't been a lot of construction in self-storage. It's been dropping the last 3 years because the interest rates were so high. But there's a lot of capital out there chasing them, a lot of institutional capital chasing those facilities. And we think there's going to be an opportunity to do holds where we're only doing 3 to 5 years.
Okay. Well, you mentioned cap rates. Let's talk about cap rates. What cap rates ranges do you typically acquire self-storage at?
We don't buy on a cap rate because we're not buying an existing facility that has income. I mean, our cap rate is zero, really. We're buying a nasty old vacant building that's been sitting empty for 5 to 10 years. It has, you know, we bought an old vacant Piggly Wiggly, which is a grocery store here in Macon, Georgia, that had been vacant for 10 years. It had a tribe of meth heads living in it for several years. It had every piece of copper stolen out of it. It was the only value of the building is essentially whatever somebody was willing to pay for it. And so it was really okay. The value of the land.
Okay. In multifamily, we obviously have certain markets that we invest in. So we actually were very data driven. So we follow certain key metrics, job growth, population growth, rent growth, income growth. Not to mention, we try to focus on landlord friendly states, business friendly states. When it comes to self storage, you mentioned you just mentioned you bought a vacant grocery store, I believe you said. What is it that you guys look for when you're looking to acquire a property and do the conversion in self storage? Is there certain metrics that you guys follow, or how do you know what's a good market to invest in?
Absolutely. So we typically are investing in secondary and tertiary markets. You're not across the Southeast right now, from Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee. We love Florida, but we're not really crazy about the insurance market in Florida right now. You're not typically going to see us in a Charlotte or an Atlanta, but you may see us in a Gastonia or a Reidsville or a Macon, you know, areas that are sort of on the outskirts of these big primary A markets. We don't typically like to go in and compete with those REIT level self storage operators, the public storage, the extra space and things like that. We like to kind of be out in those tertiary and secondary markets. Storage is a commodity. You're never going to create demand for self storage. Storage is going to be where you want to be, in a retail corridor, typically, where people are driving by it every day, driving from where they live to where they work. They see it. You typically want to be in an area where there's more than 25% of the population are renters. Renters typically are higher consumers of self storage. Oftentimes, what you'll look for in storage is what we call the supply index. And typically, this is kind of the ballpark figure that a lot of storage operators use for a number of years, which is you want a sort of a normal market. A market equilibrium is about 7 square feet of self-storage per capita. And so if there's 100,000 people in an area, then, you know, you'd expect to see about 70,000 square feet of storage. It would be the supply index. And if there's less than that, then it's usually an undersupplied market and you should be able to build new storage there and it should lease up, or it could be oversupplied if it's more than that. But the reality is that every market is different. You'll have, when I was in Las Vegas, when I was first getting started in storage, I remember looking at facilities and the supply index in Vegas was over 11 square feet per capita, which would tell you that that's an oversupplied market. Well, in reality, Las Vegas is just a market that uses a lot of self-storage because they had 11 square feet per capita, but every facility was full and they were constantly raising rates. Whereas you may go into another area and it would appear to be undersupplied, but you know, you just may have an area there where they have basements and they have big garages, or they don't have a lot of HOAs and they're able to sort of just store stuff on their property. So oftentimes when we start really digging into a market, one of the things that we'll look for is we'll literally go through and we're calling the other operators in a 1, 3, and 5 mile area from our subject site and find out whether or not they're full and what the rates that they're charging are. Because if they're full and their rates are high, then that tells us that even if it would say that supply index is high, that there's still demand there for some reason. So that's typically what we're looking for.
Yeah, that would be a very good indicator to follow. As an investor, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I was going to actually take a step back and ask you a couple of questions. You were on a roll, so I didn't want to slow you down. Sure. But you talked about conversion and you talked about how you guys take these older buildings. Is there a specific structure that works out perfectly for your business plan? Like something that comes across your desk, you're like, this is perfect. And what is that?
Yeah, I mean, vacant big boxes, anything more than about 65,000 square feet are perfect. The big open floor plan doesn't require a ton of tearing down walls and things like that. But we did a facility in Gastonia, North Carolina. There's a former Sundrop bottling plant it was kind of multiple buildings that had overbuilt over 100 years. That is a very broken up space. But we're not afraid. We're We have our own internal construction team that has experience doing this, so we're not going to shy away from them. Obviously, the conversion cost is usually going to go up the more walls that we have to tear down and the more oddly shaped we have to do our unit layout. You know, but we've done even, you know, one of our facilities in Lexington, North Carolina, was actually a sale lease back from a local brewer. You know, it was about a 90,000 square foot building. The bottom floor was the brewery. And we basically, they sold the building to us and then leased back that bottom floor. And we converted that upper floor into self-storage. But it was a nice open floor plan. It's one that's leasing up like crazy because it would seem odd. You know, you've got a self-storage facility over a brewery, but customers come there every night to drink beer and they see that this storage facility, there's just awareness that it's there. So really, August, you'd think that it would just be cut and dry. What would be perfect? Obviously, I would say that if it's a vacant big box, a big open floor plan, that's kind of ideal, but we're not going to shy away from something that will work for us.
Fair enough. And how about unit sizes? I personally have driven by self-storage facilities that are even housing, storing boats, and I've driven one closer to urban areas where there are much smaller units that don't hold anything too large. What is that sweet spot for you guys?
Yeah, it's very market driven, and we will usually do a third-party feasibility study, and they'll usually let us know. They're sort of going in detail and digging into the market and figuring out, okay, what in the competitor facilities, what units are leasing up the fastest? Are there any units that don't appear to be in demand? We have a few facilities that have boat and RV parking on them. It's not kind of a primary thing that we do. It's usually, but a lot of these facilities come with a lot of vacant land, and a lot of times we will either put boat RV parking on them, or we'll look into selling art parcels or doing a ground lease with, you know, a fast food restaurant or things like that. And the unit size, everything from 5x5 unit to 10x20, even 10x30s, usually not much bigger than 10x30s.
Got it. And just want to take a quick step back and talk about cap rates. I mean, cap rates are really gauge of risk and reward. Cap rate tells you what type of yield you can get on a property, but it depends on the risk associated with that property as well. And it is market driven as well. Some markets, a cap rate on multifamily property is higher. A cap rate is more compressed in some other markets. Depends on the asset class as well, if it's A, B, or C, core, core plus, value add, opportunistic. So, and then in development, you got unlevered yield on cost because you want to know what type of yield you're going to have after the construction is complete. When you guys are developing and rebuilding these projects, do you have a cap rate you want to be at stabilization? Like, what is your stabilized cap rate?
We've underwritten for an exit cap of about anywhere from 6 to 7%. We try to be conservative. You know, you're usually going to be in those really A-class markets like a New York City, Los Angeles, Phoenix. If you've got a giant brand new build, three-story extra space, some of those are trading at 4 caps, 5 caps. We're typically in secondary, tertiary markets, and we're typically under, like I said, we're underwriting for around 6 to 7. And obviously, you know, for us, it's not, the cap rate is obviously what we have to watch, but we're usually, August, we're creating so much value on that front end. That's where most of our value, we're forcing the appreciation on the asset class. We're taking a building that we're buying for $1.5 million. And by the time we open it and it's an empty self-storage facility, oftentimes the bank is going to come in and appraise it at CO, empty facility, anywhere from $6 to $7 million. And then usually if we lease it all the way to stabilization at 85% occupancy, and we've got an exit cap, you know, we're looking at an exit price of around 12.5 to 14 million.
What type of economics are you achieving for your LPs?
We're usually targeting, we like to try and target around a 20% IRR and a 2x equity multiple in 5 years. We've only had one exit thus far, and that was literally about a month and a half ago. We exited a Kmart conversion in Danville, Virginia. That one was originally from the very beginning a 5-year exit. We exited in 37 months and we got our return, our investors a 19%, a 17 to 19% IRR based, basically beat the IRR by about 1%, and it was about a 1.7 to 1.85 equity multiple.
Nice. Right on. Great. Amazing. As an investor, Neil, investing in a self-storage, what could go wrong in self-storage? Like when, you know, in multifamily, we always tell investors, hey, listen, like worst case scenario, for example, one worst case scenario would be everybody moves out of the building, right? Occupancy drops. So if we drop to a certain occupancy, we call it the break-even occupancy. So we let investors know, even in our monthly communication, what occupancy the building is at. So what is that like in self-storage? Do you guys have similar numbers that you share with investors?
Yeah, we're typically targeting it on a conversion. We can usually hit break even occupancy around 40 to 45%, but a lot of that depends on what kind of rent we're getting. And I will say, worst case scenario for storage has been the last 3 years. It's been a really, really tough time in self-storage. Maybe not quite as hard as multifamily, but a lot of what happened in the last 3 years with storage was when the interest rates shot up and housing prices shot up at the same time, which is an unusual thing to happen. Normally, when you have interest rates rise, you'll usually see housing prices come down. That froze the housing market. And so you had a huge drop in people moving, which is one of the primary drivers of demand drivers for self-storage. And traditionally, we would see facilities leasing up. For 30 years, facilities would lease up on around 3% per month, which means that if you have an empty facility, it's going to lease up to stabilization in about 28 to 30 months. And we saw that Danville property, we opened the doors there in, was it May of 23? We leased up right on pro forma for 12 months. And then all of a sudden, April of 24, when the housing prices and interest rates hit, all of a sudden it dropped to about 1.2%. So now you're talking a facility that was going to lease up to stabilization in about 28 months. Now you're looking at 50 months. And we, luckily for us, because we bought at such a low cost basis and we'd created so much value right out of the gate, it didn't put us in any distress. And then ultimately, you know, as the market has been starting to turn this last spring, we had an operator capital partner who was hungry for self-storage, came to us. We weren't really looking to sell, but they made us an offer that was about $1 million over our net present value. And it just made sense for our investors to take some chips off the table and exit.
Amazing. Okay, right on, Neil. I want to switch the conversation a little bit to something that I'm very passionate about. And you mentioned in your bio that you helped raise over $17 million for self-storage. Now, this really comes down to myself here at CPI Capital. I'm more focused on the equity side of the business. And nothing excites me more than the psychology of investors. Nothing excites me more than cracking the code to communicating with people, to understanding their emotions and connecting with them in order for them to build this know, like, and trust with you to eventually invest their hard-earned money with you. So talk to us about how you connected with investors. How did you build trust with investors to raise $17 million? Because for people who are listening, $17 million of capital to raise is not an easy task. I mean, I'd say raising equity is one of the toughest parts of syndication, right? And I'm sure you can agree with that. But talk to us about your journey in raising that amount of capital.
Well, I mean, you took the words out of my mouth. And the key phrase there is know, like, and trust. People are going to invest with people they know. And there's circles. Those initial investors were people who had known us for a long time. I give ample credit to my partner, Clint Harris, who's a medical device salesman, who had a lot of our early investors were white coat professionals that he'd built a relationship with. They were friends of mine. They were family members of mine. A lot of those early investors it's kind of a white knuckle prospect of getting your friends and families to come in and invest with you. When we had experience in self-storage and commercial real estate, but we hadn't syndicated. We hadn't done anything with investors on those first deals before. We syndicated our first deal in October of 21. And you start thinking to yourself, you know, if this goes bad, man, Thanksgivings are going to be uncomfortable. But I also really believed in our team and I believed in the asset class and I believed in our business plan. And so that early capital we raised, I think, for probably those first six deals, and our deals are not huge. We're raising on average $1 million to $1.5 million. You know, these are not $25 million multifamily deals that we're buying. You know, so they're fairly small raises comparatively. And so early on, we were able to raise from friends and family. And then eventually, you know, those friends and families get tapped out and you start having to go outside that. And you start then sort of getting to know people who know them. You know, go to that next circle. It's not the people who directly know you. It's people who know the people who know you. And, you know, and then your conversion rate gets a little bit lower. And then eventually we were doing all our raises as 506B syndications, which we could take non-accredited investors. We still like to start a lot of our raises like that because we want to bring along our friends and family that are not accredited. But that presents a lot of challenges for you. You can't generally solicit, you can't advertise, and it becomes very hard for people to get to know that you exist, because you're just having to just brute force, just go out and network with people and talk to people. And you can't specifically talk about what your deals are, but they have to get to know you. And then you build a substance of relationship. And then eventually you can start talking to them about your deals. So we opened our first fund about a year and a half ago. It was a $10 million fund for the purchase of 4 to 6 conversion projects. And we raised about $4 million from as a 506B syndication there. And then we converted it to a 506C. And we started generally soliciting for the first time. We started advertising on Meta. If you are on Facebook or Instagram, you click on one syndicator's ad, you're probably going to see a lot more of them. You'll probably see mine or Clint's face at some point. And then you just start getting a very different type of investor. Ava, I don't know if you've experienced this. It's a very different conversation where you're talking to somebody who knows you or knows someone who knows you, to someone who literally just clicked on an ad on Meta. And I'll stop and let you ask some follow-up questions, because otherwise I'll just go on and on.
No, go ahead right there. Differentiate between those two.
Yeah, please. I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, it is. So it's a very different conversation. You know, you have to, with someone who has clicked on an ad on Facebook or Instagram, they don't know you. Something about the ad spoke to them. That it usually has to do with the asset class. And in the reality, that's not usually what people are investing in. People are normally going to invest. It's what a lot of inexperienced investors are going to focus on. The smart investors are very quickly going to want to know who you are. They want to invest in the jockey, not the horse. And so a lot of those early conversations are going to deal with, when I'm talking to an investor, I'm usually talking to them about, all right, what are your goals? What are you looking to get out of this? Because I know that if somebody comes to us and they're looking to replace an income, they're looking for immediate cash flow, I will very quickly tell them, listen, we are not the operators for you. These are not the opportunities. We don't cash flow for, you know, at least 36 months. You know, this is more of a growth play. And usually that will weed out some people. But then often some people, like, you know, when you tell them no, oftentimes this psychology will click in, like, well, now I really want to know what you guys are about. And oftentimes those conversations are just trying to educate people on who we are, what the asset class is, and what our business plan is, and trying to feel out whether or not our business plan is going to align with their goals. And then it's just a matter of them getting to know us. It usually takes a lot longer. There's a lot longer timeline from the time someone meets us to the time that they're actually willing to hand over their capital and sign a subscription agreement. And the conversion rate is a lot lower. So it's just it almost becomes a numbers game at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I can relate. I would say, you know, when I have calls with investors who clicked on an ad, for example, the first question I always ask them is, hey, how much do you know about our company? And I found that some investors literally went down a rabbit hole and researched and knew a lot about me, and they clicked on an ad. Those are the investors that actually invested right away, but with only coming in for the last. So you get the people who go down the rabbit hole, just like you do with bigger pockets, right? So they do know a lot about you. Hey, I heard you had, you know, I heard you say you had 2 kids, and I'm like, wow, you know a lot about me. We just threw the ad out last week. And then you're right. You do have all these people who are now following you, which is just going to set you up for success in the future. So well said. I guess we can switch the conversation again. You talked about FIRE, which is Financial Independence Early Retirement Movement. Can you talk to us about that? What is this all about? It's the first time I've heard of it.
Wow. So I first heard about it from a man by the name of, he goes by the moniker, Mr. Money Mustache. And the whole idea, and it was the first time that anyone had put into my head the math around financial independence. I mean, I had dreamed of financial independence since I was probably 30 years old, when I sort of was like, oh, okay, like at some point I'm going to want to stop working. And how do I do that? And I had first learned about investing in the stock market, but I never really knew the math behind it. Anybody who invests in the stock market and you know about retirement, you know about the 4% rule. And that's essentially like you take what it's going to take for you to live in retirement, and you divide that number by 4%, it's usually, or you multiply it by 25 times. And that will tell you how much of a nest egg that you're going to have to build up in order to stop working. And you will be able to, you know, let's say you have $3 million in a nest egg and you have a 4%. The 4% rule means that you can basically spend $120,000 a year of that money while it grows at 7 to 10% earning the stock market. Well, that's the nest egg approach. Once I got into real estate, I started focusing partly on what I would call a cash flow approach. And I do both. I invest in the stock market, but I love real estate and I love the cash flow approach and I love the forced appreciation that real estate gives me. And so the idea there is, all right, I know I've got a number on my head of what I would like to have when I stop working. And the goal is to build up a mix of a nest egg and cash flowing assets that pay me enough that it meets those goals. And once you've hit it, you're now work optional. And the nice thing about the cash flow approach is that you don't have to get to 100%. And that's kind of where I got to in 2021. I am not financially free by any stretch of the imagination. I have very low cost of living because I house hack. I live at a house across the street from the beach. It's a one half of a three-story townhome. And we live on the top two floors and the bottom floor is an apartment. It's a totally separate entrance that we rent out on Airbnb and it pays our mortgage. So right there, I've removed one of the largest expenses that most people have. My housing is essentially paid for by a tenant downstairs. And then I had a couple of long-term rentals that have done really well for me that are paying me a pretty good amount per month. And that created a certain amount of financial runway for me that in September of 21, I was able to say, go to my employer of 18 years and say, hey, I'm done. I had the opportunity to take a chance on myself and go off and be a full-time real estate investor at a self-storage private equity firm. And I moved all the way across the country. It was not easy. I don't necessarily recommend people do it exactly the way I did. It's been a hard fought 3 years. There's been a lot of belt tightening. We're just now coming out what a lot of us would call sort of the valley of death. And things are starting to pay out. Things are starting to cash flow. But that's the basics of it.
Incredible. Well, good for you. Whenever you get up and out of your comfort zone, success usually finds you at some point. So good for you.
That's perfect. Yeah. Thank you for sharing all that with us, giving us a crash course on self-storage and your journey. Well, now we're going to move to any other questions, Ava?
No, I'm good.
We're going to move to the second segment of our show,
which is the 10 championship rounds to financial freedom. So are you ready, Neil?
I'm ready. Hang on. Let me prepare my drink of water. Yeah.
Take a sip of water. Perfect. Here we go. So whatever comes top of mind, there's 10 questions. Let's get started. First question is, who's been the most influential person in your life?
Influential person in my life or real estate life?
In your life.
Which includes real estate life too, right?
I'd have to say my mom and dad. My mom, I'll credit with instilling in me a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit and pushing me to sort of take that leap. And then my dad was my best friend until he died in March of 2020 and just giving me a great example of a person and a father to aspire to.
What was your mom an immigrant?
Nope. She grew up in Baytown, Texas. And yeah, she was a Texas girl, came from a very poor family, did not end up going to college. She married my dad at 19. He was an Air Force officer and then became a stay-at-home mom until I was 9 years old. And in 1979, she became a sales secretary at a local TV station and eventually became the general sales manager. And she became the primary breadwinner in our family.
All right, Neil, next question. What is the number one book you'd recommend?
This is an easy one. I read this at least once a year. It's called Atomic Habits by James Clear. I use it as a reset every year to just kind of remind me of that I'm doing habits that are making a vote for the person I want to be instead of the person I don't want to be.
That's awesome. I have that book in my Audible library. Nice. I just haven't read it yet, so I'll have to read it.
Highly recommend it. It'll change your life.
Right on. Awesome. Thank you. All right. Next question. If you had the opportunity to travel back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
Oh, goodness. Don't buy a one-year-old condo in Las Vegas, Nevada after it had doubled in value in a year. And in 2013, buy as much real estate as I could get my hands on, especially self-storage.
How about non-financial related advice? What else would you give, like broadly about your life? What would you tell yourself if you had a chance to go back and be super young?
That's a good question. August, I've thought about this a lot. And there's even a science fiction book called Replay about a man who gets stuck in a sort of a groundhog time loop, except he keeps dying at age 40 and going back to 18 years old and lives his life over with all the knowledge he had before. I've thought about that. Of like, all right, what would I go back and do different? I'm sort of answering the question I want to ask and maybe not the one you're asking. And I eventually came to the conclusion is I wouldn't change a thing because who I am now, the life I have now was built by all the mistakes, all of the hardship that I went through in my life before. I love my wife, I love my son, and I love my life, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Got it. Any pointers you would give yourself? I think we all feel the same way. We always go back and wonder if you want to change anything. And the loved ones that we have, we're like, hey, if I took one step differently, I wouldn't have been with Ava and I wouldn't have two sons now today. So there's, you want to be very careful when you go back in life and try to change things. But how about an advice? How about if you were your own coach when you were super young and you could just whisper a few things in your ears, what would those be?
Probably play fewer video games. Played a lot of video games in my younger, in my 20s. I drank too much. I've been sober now for a year, a little over a year, and not for any kind of, I didn't have any alcoholism or I'm not a teetotaler. I will still, you know, take a drink when I want to, but I just found that it wasn't really adding much to my life and I gave it up.
That is awesome. Every 20-year-old that I meet, I literally tell them, don't drink. Don't drink alcohol. Be the person in the room that doesn't drink alcohol. I mean, I haven't drank in 6 years, August. You haven't drank in
15 years.
15 years, right? Like, yeah, don't drink alcohol. There's no good that comes from it. So that's good for you. That's amazing. I love that. Next question.
First time since the 40s, drinking in the U.S. has dropped. And the lowest level has been since the 40s today.
You want to know why? Because health is becoming of importance. Longevity is becoming of importance. And people don't think it's cool to drink anymore. And it's not cool to drink anymore. What's powerful is if you're the person in the room who's the most exciting person to talk to in the room on top of not drinking. I mean, it doesn't get better than that, right?
Yeah. So that's when you maybe you thought I was high-end drunk. But then you're like, this is the most sober guy I've ever met. And you fell in love with me.
Thank
and
you.
Married me a few months later.
Because I'm kind of a naturally introverted person, and a lot of times alcohol gives you that social lubricant out of the introversion. So I've had to learn to be a conversationalist without alcohol.
And that's amazing. And that's incredible.
All right, let's get bang through these. Try to still close if we can in the next few minutes here.
Got it. Okay, next question. What's the best investment you've ever made?
The beach house I'm living in right now.
Nice. Okay. Now that leads me to the next question. What's the worst investment you've ever made? And what lessons did you learn from it?
Aside from the condo in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Can I hold on to that condo in Las Vegas? Because that really was the, that was the first piece of real estate I ever bought.
That was a liver shot, as we call it in boxing. That put you down. So, you know, got to remember that for the rest of your life. Let's go next one.
Okay. Here's a good one, Neil, which you kind of went over a little bit, but how much would you need in the bank to retire today? What's your number?
Oh, goodness. Somewhere between $3 and $5 million.
Okay.
That seems to be
and I think that's actually a pretty big number. I think people can get by on way less. That's my big number.
Nice. Good. Okay. Next question. If you could have dinner with someone dead or alive, who would it be?
My dad. Absolutely.
That's in peace. Next question, Neil. If you weren't doing what you're doing today, what would you be doing now?
Goodness. I was an actor in another life, a professional actor, not a very well-paid professional actor. And I think I would do that. Or an underwater photographer.
Oh, nice. Fun. My favorite question, Neil, book smarts or street smarts?
Oh, goodness. I am a believer that you can become book smart. I think anybody can become book smart. Street smarts, hey, great, you got it. But I think ultimately it comes down to what you do with those smarts and whether or not you take action. Because a lot of people will get lost in the books and never actually take action.
So what was your answer? Street smarts?
I'll give the benefit to book smarts.
Wow. You 250 guests. We had only one guest. 350. You only had one guest who said book smart. Now it's two. So it's getting close to that 1% mark now.
That's great. Right. Okay.
Didn't I say book smarts too? When I was interviewed? But go on. Let's go. Last question.
Last question, y'all. If you had $1 million in cash and you had to make one investment today, what would it be?
Oh, goodness. Right now, if I couldn't invest in one of our own deals, I would probably invest in some sort of cash flow fund. There's a lot of debt funds out there. I think there's some really good ones that are sort of blended. They're essentially lending out to house slippers at 15% and they're paying anywhere from 9 to 10% annually.
Nice.
Awesome. Great.
Last thing, if you could just tell the viewers, what's the best way that they can reach you, please?
Absolutely. Neil, N-E-I-L. I spell that the correct way, not the sociopath way, N-E-I-L at nomadcapital.us.
Got it. Perfect. Thank you, Neil, for being here. Thank you for sharing all your knowledge and wisdom. And I appreciate you.
This has been great. Thanks, Neil.
August and Ava, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. We hope this conversation enlightened you on how to win big in this highly profitable and risk-averse space. Get on your feet and embrace this world that offers so many opportunities just waiting for you out there. Continue your journey to becoming a savvy real estate expert by subscribing to the show at cpicapital.ca. Don't forget to leave a positive rating and share with your friends. See you on the next one.